Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:17 p.m. That is Pacific Standard Time. Today is Friday, and it's November 23rd, and of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought I would kick off this week by talking about energy. I also want to talk about debt and the extent to which we've seen some significant sell-offs, not just in treasuries but in the wider market. We've also been seeing that high yield spreads have been expanding. I also want to talk about the wider stock market environment and where we are in terms of the interest rate cycle. Those I think are going to be some of the more important facts. Then there are other things that need to be talked about as well, not least what's going on in emerging markets, the deterioration in growth prospects for China. Then you have the rise of populism, and the most acute source of worry in Europe right now is in both the UK and in Italy, and those are both as a response to this breaking of the status quo. Well, when you list it all out, it does sound like a lot to get through. So let's get started. Well, this has been a really quite profound decline in oil prices, coming from a peak above 85 to almost 55 in just the last 7 or 8 weeks, and this has very clearly broken the downtrend, the uptrend. So now there's this very big question that I think we have now have answered. The big question out there from over the last 3 years was how high could prices rise before significant new sources of supply came onto the market? Well, we have our answer. It's about $80 on Brent crude. We pretty much know where the lower side of the range is. It's between about $30 and $40. It's very hard for prices to sustain a move below the $30 area because that's such a key level of where so many sources of supply become completely uneconomic. It's when it's at that price that you start to see supply getting shut in, and not just on a short-term basis. But when prices get up above $70, well, that's when unconventional supply starts to really come to market. It's when the drillers can start to hedge out their production for anything up to a year to 18 months. And that's something that they can go to the bank with. That's where they can really say to people that they're looking to for funding that they can make money at these levels for anything for out to 18 months. So therefore, give us the money now. You're definitely going to get your return. And that's exactly what we've seen happen, that there was a surge in U.S. supply over the summer because prices had been sustaining around this $70 area for a while, and that offered drillers some visibility on what their future cash flows were going to be. Well, when prices got above $80, then there is the additional wrinkle here that Saudi Arabia needed some cover for their assassination of the journalist Khashoggi. So that has been provided by President Trump, and they have rather, I think, comfortably decided that the quid pro quo was that they're going to increase supply, and that has contributed to this very sharp decline in oil prices. It is accelerating lower. It's been completely unrequiting over the course of the last 8 weeks, and this week is the biggest decline that we've seen so far. It is certainly starting to look climactic, and not least as it comes back down and tests the upper side of that underlying trading range between 2016 and 17. But we need a clear upper dynamic to really confirm that the shorts are being pressured, and a rally of more than $3, probably more like $4, is going to be required to even begin to pressure the short positions, and upside follow through would also then be required to really catalyze that we have more than a very, very short term low. But when we look at the price right now, well, it is almost 14 full dollars overextended relative to the trend mean on the downside. So we have certainly seen a lot of bearish news getting priced in a very rapid manner. Well, when we look at the outlook for some of the major producers, BP had broken up and out of what was effectively a 7-year base formation, and now it is coming right back down to test the low, the upper side of that underlying trading range. If this is a first step above the base, well, then it's going to have to hold the 500p level. So we are at a rather interesting juncture here for BP, and it's a reasonably similar story for Royal Dutch Shell. It has come back to test the progression of higher reaction lows. This has not been an especially consistent advance. The most consistent thing about it is that it has held this sequence of higher reaction lows, and every single time that it has pulled back below the trend mean, it has rebounded within a few months. So we're now getting to a point where if the bullish outlook is to be sustained, then it's going to have to bounce pretty soon. Now, when we look at ExxonMobil as a US example, well, it has had this sequence of lower rally highs over the course of the last 3 years. So this is not nearly as consistent a trend as the UK major energy providers. And Exxon is coming right back down now to test the lower side of this range. But it has a lot of work to do to really confirm that we're in a demand-dominated environment. Then, if we look at, hold on, I've put up the wrong chart. If we look at EOG Resources, then that had been trending higher rather comfortably until about the middle of this year. Then you started to see these failed upside breaks, and now we have the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. It is right now testing its most recent higher major reaction low and the $100 area. So if it's going to bounce, well, this would be a rather, I think, convenient place for it to do so. But the much bigger picture here is that we've seen a significant peak in oil prices. So we're in a multi-year range, and all we have to do to get some perspective on what that looks like is to look at an extraordinarily long-term history of the oil market. So we can go back to 1865 on a monthly basis, and if we look at that on a log scale chart, well, what we can see are ranges followed by phenomenal bull markets followed by ranges, and those ranges can last anything up to about 20 years. Well, if the most significant peak we've seen in a long time was in 2008, well, we're 10 years into this range. Now, we can also see that at the peak in 1981, prices sustained at a reasonably high level for a pretty long time and then pulled back violently. And subsequently, the range was significantly below the peak levels. And that persisted despite, even with the Gulf War spike on the upside, that persisted for a very long time. Well, there is the very realistic possibility today that we have now seen the peak, that this what we're seeing today is similar to what we saw back in 1987, and that we could be now in a very lengthy range where the lower side is in the upper 30s and the upper side is in the 70s to 80s, and that could persist for an awfully long time. There is a massive manufacturing build of battery technology going on right now. And there are two aspects to batteries. The first, of course, is the technology itself. Well, the technology itself and the energy density of batteries is improving, but at a reasonably slow pace. But the cost of delivering on the current technology is improving at a pace of approximately 20% a year. So when you start to think about a vehicle that has got a range of 250 miles, which is going to, I think, be more than enough for the vast majority of commuters. Well, the price of that car is going to be coming down steadily over the course of the next few years. What it also means is that because the cost of producing those batteries is declining, that the and the process for producing those batteries is considerably less complex than designing internal combustion engines, is it really means that the barriers to entry into the automotive sector are falling very quickly. That's why Tesla has been able to go from nothing to become the biggest producer of sedans in the USA. It's also why Dyson have been able to decide that they want to enter the market because the barrier to entry has been declining. Well, that's terrible news for the automotive sector. It really does highlight the fact that we're probably going to see about half of those companies go bust, and that it's probably going to be a very small number eventually do succeed. Well, Volkswagen said this week that they're going to invest upwards of $50 billion in retooling their factories. But if we think about it another way, that all the money they spent on clean diesel is now a write-off. That represents a very significant toll, but it also represents a very difficult challenge for various economies, because producing cars has been a major industry. It's one of the better manufacturing sectors. It's high paying. It's also technologically advanced. It's also capital intensive, and it supports an ecosystem in the wider economy of suppliers. Well, internal combustion engines have got a lot more parts than electric vehicles. The biggest component in an electric vehicle is the battery. Europe doesn't have one big battery factory, and it's going to be a while before they do have one. Well, then that pretty much means that it is the countries producing the batteries are going to be the real beneficiaries going forward from the automotive sector. And that's right now, that isn't Germany. That's China, South Korea, and Japan. And with Tesla, you have a battery factory in the USA. Well, that represents a very significant change. It represents a challenge for the oil market because oil is primarily a transportation fuel, and that is going to represent a bearish fact, quite apart from the fact that you have had this game changer in terms of unconventional supply. So now you have this additional game changer. Well, two game changers that are negative for prices in the context of a market that had been trending higher for a decade is really quite bad news, and it points towards a secular bear market. So that is, I think, what we have to anticipate from energy prices, that we are in now a secular bear market for prices. The one commodity in the energy sector that is doing well right now is natural gas. Well, there are two aspects to this. One is that infrastructure has not been keeping pace with supply growth, and the USA is now an exporter of the commodity, so inventories were below what they would normally have been at this particular time of year, and now we have some cold weather, so that has resulted in some short covering. It's probably also resulted this massive move we've seen on the upside has probably been the result of some pairs trading as well, where people have been shorting the oil price and buying natural gas. But we can see clearly on this decade-long trend, I think, what we can probably anticipate from oil prices. I've been saying this now for what feels like an awfully long time, that natural gas gives us a picture of what we can anticipate from oil prices. And it is likely that natural gas is going to start pulling back again from this $5 area. Having been in positive territory in here today, it reversed the decline, and it looks like we're going to see this move come all the way back down. the simple fact of the matter is that there is no shortage of natural gas. It is just simply a supply bottleneck to get it to the markets it's required at. And if the frigid temperatures moderate at all, then the price is going to come back down in a very violent manner. Now, if we then think about the pace of technological innovation, then what's happening in the stock market right now is really about interest rates, it's about the trade war, but it's also about the fact that a lot of the good news from the technology sector has been priced into shares like Apple and Amazon. When people think about Apple's ecosystem, well, the ecosystem is not the primary profit center that Apple has. The profit center is selling phones, and they're selling fewer of them. Everyone who wants an iPhone probably has one, and therefore they're really just relying on people buying new ones. Well, the price has pulled back on two previous occasions in a violent manner, and then has subsequently ranged for anything from 2 to 3 years. So it's quite likely that that is now what we are seeing in Apple. And it's going to require something new and potentially a 5G phone. They have already said that they're looking at about 2020 when they bring that out. Well, Samsung are looking at bringing out a 5G phone next year. And the share price has been trending lower just about all year. That has certainly broken the uptrend from that really persisted all the way through 2016 and 2017. But there is the additional point that Samsung's valuations have an estimated PE of 6 and a dividend yield of 3, whereas Apple, certainly not the most expensive share in the world, but it has an estimated PE of 12 and a yield of 1.7. So its valuation is double that of Samsung, but Samsung would appear to be on the cusp of having a technological advantage relative to Apple. Then you also have, for example, Google. Well, Google was the most consistent trend in the world, and now it is less consistent. That tells us that this incredible advance that has been predicated on the ubiquity of the Google search engine business and its advertising engine is already in the price. Now, the next question is, what is Google going to do that's new that can generate enough revenue to justify prices above $1,200? Well, Google's answer to that question is probably going to be commercializing YouTube or the potential for autonomous vehicles with Waymo. Well, autonomous vehicles are potentially a total game changer for the global economy. Not only would they result in massive layoffs, considering that there are approximately, in Europe alone, there are upwards of 4 million people whose job is driving, whether that is driving for delivery trucks, driving for mail, or driving for any other purpose. We're talking approximately 4 million people that is their job. Well, Uber is predicated on eventually being able to deliver autonomous driving. That is the only way that company is going to get to a position of profitability. It says a lot that the company had absolutely no interest whatsoever in an IPO until they started killing people with their autonomous program and had to cancel it. At least they canceled it in Arizona. Well, if Uber has concluded that they are not at a point where they are going to be the first in the market with an autonomous vehicle, well, now is the time to sell the business, because when someone else comes up with it, the share is going to go to zero. Because why would anyone want to own Uber that does not have autonomous vehicles but has hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of employees that are driving people around, when you have autonomous vehicles doing it for considerably less? Well, one way or the other, that suggests that Uber's employees are all going to be made unemployed. Well, that represents a significant challenge. When we think about the fact that you have this rise in populism and the what is effectively a revolt against the status quo, rather than, and I think that the way to think about it is that it is not simply, it is, I think, too simple to think about this as a rise of populism or of anti-Semitism or isolationism or anti-immigrant, or then you have the, on the other side of the equation, you have the Me Too movement, you have the identity politics, you have the rise of the LGBTQ designation, gender fluidity, which is increasingly becoming a factor. What all of these things are doing is trying to say, what about me? Every single one of these has this exact same rationale. Everyone is asking this thing, what about me? Well, that is very different from the kind of engagement that we had in the global economy over the last 40 years, which was much more inclusive. That everyone was told that your life can get better because, yes, you're job might have been exported to China, but they're going to become much more liberal and a partner in the global economy, and that is going to make everybody's life better. That and besides, we have all of these social programs that we're going to be able to deliver to you, and you're going to have to work less, and your life will improve. Well, the credit crisis disabused everybody of that illusion because services were cut. Jobs disappeared. Jobs were impossible to get. You had to be connected in order to get a job. That what my sister, who has a PhD in essentially environmental science and geography, was moved home from after spending a decade working as a senior lab tech in Trinity College Dublin, and was told that she didn't have the requisite experience for an entry-level job in a local college, and most found out later that the job had been given to someone who was related to someone who was on the committee. Well, that's a perfect example of the kind of connectedness that is required to get jobs in lots of different countries. It's not simply in developed countries or emerging countries, but when you have a situation where there is not enough to go around, well, then nepotism starts to come back in. Well, these are major challenges, and what we're seeing and is that this rise of populism is as a direct response to that. Well, technological innovation is inherently deflationary, but I think it's probably more correct to think about it as disinflation and a drive towards efficiency. But technology in itself is not particularly a job killer. It's historically, when we've seen technology coming through, it has resulted in jobs changing. That you certainly need more re-education, you need people to be willing to move, and you also need the a social infrastructure. It is globalization which has resulted in the denuding of countries of their manufacturing. And manufacturing is one of the most important sectors for one very simple reason. It is the primary mechanism for people that do not are not particularly academic to achieve a reasonable standard of living. A lot of the services jobs that these manufacturing jobs have been replaced with pay considerably less. So that has contributed to reduced standards of living for whole segments of society. Well, if you're looking for a reason why we have this rise of populism all over the world, then that is one of the primary reasons for it. That people who are less educated have now got much fewer opportunities to achieve a reasonable standard of living than they had before. And the social infrastructure and support mechanisms that have been funded with debt are now looking increasingly unaffordable. So this is going to take us down the rabbit hole in terms of exploring what alternative strategies there are. Well, when we think about what we can anticipate, therefore, from government bonds, then we have some enormous questions here, because government bond yields have been trending down, and that has made the debt-fueled social program, centrism trend affordable. But now we're starting to see that yields are rising. They're rising from incredibly low levels. And it makes absolutely no sense to talk about yields that used to be 16%. Because when you're talking about funding, then are refinancing an enormous quantity of debt, well, then small moves in the interest rate have an incredible effect on the affordability. And when you start to see these sorts of metrics coming through, well, it's going to raise the very important question about unfunded liabilities. So this is going to represent an election issue for the foreseeable future. When we think about the next general election in any country that you wish to name, when you think about the presidential election cycle in the USA, well, these are going to be questions that are going to come up with greater urgency at every single election that we have in the developed world for at least the next decade. So, how that political environment plays out is going to have a profound effect on asset prices, because we are at a point where some extraordinary measures are going to need to be taken. And the potential is that there is going to be debt forgiveness somewhere along the line. Well, that's really not great news for pensions. So when we think about the risks that are outstanding, well, there are clear risks in the credit market. Now, what's equally interesting is that LBOs have been among the best performing leveraged buyouts and leveraged bond funds have been among the best performers over the last while. And then you have high yield debt, which has been completely inert for a year and a half, and spreads in the USA broke out last week and extended the advance in here this week. Well, when we think about the outlook that we have for the wider market, well, we know that the USA has been the outperformer over the last couple of years. But when we also then look at high yield elsewhere, well, the strength of the dollar has put pressure on just about everyone, everywhere. And that is, I think, an incredibly important fact. So when we look at, for example, high yield spreads in Europe, well, what we're presented with is a market that has been under pressure now for a year already. We haven't had a very large move, but the pace of the widening in credit spreads is picking up. Well, we can also look back at what happened in 2014 and 2015, because that was the most equivalent time that we're seeing compared to now. Well, back then, high yield spreads had been trending higher for a year and a bit more than that, and then popped above 500 basis points. Well, that was when we started to see real pressure starting to come to bear on the credit markets, and that was when we started to see a meaningful change in terms of central bank policy. Now, when we look at the exact same thing going on in China, well, this is an Asian high yield spread index, but the most important point is that it's at new highs. It's breaking out on the upside. It's been trending higher all year. And we are now back approximating spreads that were last seen at the beginning of 2016, but we're at 623 basis points. So this is a meaningful change in terms of the movement, considering that the spread a year ago, or really in January, was less than 300 basis points. So the high yield spread has doubled. Well, China has got more high yield debt than just about anyone else. So that's a very important point, that if we're looking for where the greatest pressure is coming to bear on the credit markets, well, it's in China. China is where you have this massive source of high yield debt. And I think that this is an interesting graphic where you see Chinese versus Asian high yield corporate bond yields. So the blue one is China. So you can see that not only does China have more, but that the yields on Chinese debt are dragging the rest of the region's high yield debt spreads higher. So I think that's one of the really key points here, that when we're thinking about what are the risks, well, certainly the risk is that when we think about high yield, then China has got to be part of the risk parameters. But then you also have the fact that people are starting to worry about fallen angels. Well, fallen angels would be investment grade companies that get downgraded to junk. And that represents a significant problem for investment grade funds because they can't hold them. They have to sell. Well, that's exactly what we've started to see with General Electric. When we look at unsubordinated debt, then yields have gone, and sorry, I didn't hit the correct yellow key, I think. Well, when we look at these high yield debts, then there is the potential that GE is going to get downgraded to junk. And that has resulted in people selling extraordinarily aggressively. Well, it's quite unusual that you see a company like General Electric trading with a 20% yield handle. Well, the yield has now contracted to about 17% from 21% at the beginning of this week. So definitely people are now starting to think that there is some value coming in here. Because when you're talking about credit, you're not really talking about the value of the equity, but rather you're talking about default probabilities. And if you're thinking about that, well, certainly GE is in a world of trouble. But it isn't as if they don't have assets. And the pace of the advance is declining rapidly. It is now coming back down towards the lows seen in 2009. But it's a very different company now than it was then. In fact, it has sold off its financial arm, and that might be part of the reason why it's declining so much, because that was also its major profit engine. But nonetheless, the price is 50% overextended on the downside relative to the trend mean. So that at least suggests that we are due a bounce. But the big question is whether a company like this is going to default. If it doesn't default, well, then the bonds are now starting to represent value. But this is, I think, just a pocket of what we're seeing in the wider market. There is certainly stress coming to bear because when we think about the weighted average cost of capital, this is the way that people start to think that. Usually, when we look at a company, the equity is a lot cheaper than, or excuse me, is a lot more expensive than the debt. Well, when you think about the weighting that GE has, where the equity and the debt are reasonably similar in weighting, well, then equity does cost more. But when you look at, for example, Apple, you're going to get a very different designation. Because 90% of their weighting is in equity, and that costs considerably more than the debt. So Apple has got a significant argument for buying back its shares and to borrow in order to do so, because the cost of the debt is low, and The benefit that it can accrue to its balance sheet by buying back the equity is really obvious when you start to run the numbers. Well, this is one of the rationales that companies use to buy back their debt and to issue, excuse me, to buy back their equity and to issue debt. And that's also been one of the primary factors behind this massive growth in debt. But of course, equity doesn't have to be refinanced, and debt does. And this only looks like an attractive proposition when debt is relatively cheap. When debt becomes more expensive, well, then that puts pressure on balance sheets, and that's when companies issue more equity. Well, that's not something that we've seen yet. What we are seeing is an increasingly large number of companies coming to IPO. So, that is representing a source of supply coming onto the market. We're still seeing a lot of companies buying back their shares. But the first thing they do before they start issuing new shares is they stop buying them back. So that is something that we have to become progressively more attuned to when we look at the potential risks in the market. Well, the Invesco Buyback Achievers ETF has been largely range-bound for the whole year. It's looking relatively similar to the S&P 500 right now, but it is constituted by shares that have bought back at least 5% of their market cap in the last 12 months on a rolling basis. Now, the very big question here is whether the S&P 500 is going to bounce, because what we have certainly seen over the course of the last year has been that it has lost momentum after a particularly impressive and consistent advance. And we've also now seen a failed upside break, and it came right back down and tested the lower side of the range. Now it is testing that low, and it has encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean. Well, what that suggests is we are at a point now that is largely do or die for the market. Now, the very big question that lots of people are going to be asking is, what is the Federal Reserve going to do? Well, when we think about the way that the Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates, I think it is important to keep an eye on what the shadow banking sector has been doing. There is always a shadow banking sector. That's one of the points that Ray Dalio has made. And there are also alternative sources of financing. Well, this market in particular has had a massive source of new financing, and it has provided this huge way for companies to source financing, and that's blockchain. And Bitcoin has crashed in no uncertain terms, and it broke lower at the beginning of this week and quickly lost $2,000 of its value. Unfortunately, the Atlanta Fed is no longer updating this measure. They stopped when the level got back to zero. But what it does highlight is that the rates available to the shadow banking sector were extraordinarily accommodative after quantitative easing was introduced. And they went negative, and then they went progressively more negative until the Fed began to taper. Well, the Fed funds rate today is at 2.25%. And it's likely to go to 2.5% in December. So let me just bring that to the right level. Well, if we look at the trend, then we can see that if we're thinking about that, this is still a reasonably consistent trend with a progression of lower rally highs. This is about where we could anticipate that the Federal Reserve might thinking about pausing. Well, if that is indeed the case, that would represent at least a tailwind to the global economy, because it would start to take some of the upward pressure from the dollar. The dollar index has been trending higher for most of the year, and it continues to hold this move above 96. It posted an upside key reversal on Tuesday from the 96 level, and it's beginning to follow through on the upside in here today. The strength of the dollar has been one of the most acute factors in the contraction of central bank balance sheets over the course of this year. Central bank balance sheets have contracted by approximately 1.5 trillion since March, but that contraction has coincided with the strength of the dollar. If we were to strip out the dollar, then central bank balance sheets would have seen some expansion from Europe and from Japan, but because of the strength of the dollar, then that expansion has been neutralized. The fact that emerging markets have been trending lower all year and have been a significant source of underperformance for the global economy is in part due to the fact that global liquidity conditions have been tightening. So we're at an incredibly important juncture right now because there are issues evolving in the credit markets, and credit does tend to lead the equity markets. Then we have the fact that high yield spreads are starting to expand. Well, that's reflective of the issues that are occurring in the credit markets. Then you also have the global banking sector, and this the KBW Nasdaq Global Banks Index is comprised of all the systemically important the SIFIs, so systemically important financial institutions. Well, it looks almost exactly like the emerging markets index. And the emerging markets index looks exactly like Tencent, and Tencent is one of the biggest Chinese companies. So, therefore, when we think about one of the bigger issues that is out there, it's got to be in China. The epicenter of global risk today is in China. And because Europe is such a big export-oriented trade bloc that depends on imports from China, well, then that also represents a significant headwind. If it wasn't, and as if that wasn't enough, then you have the fact that the automotive sector is underperforming in a big way, and that is a big problem for Europe. And that's before we even begin to talk about the internal conflicts that the Eurozone has. Because when we think about the fact that global banks have been trending lower, well, European banks are at new reaction lows and are coming right down to the lows seen in 2016 and 2015. But the primary point is that this is not the same index as it was back in 2016 or in 2012, because so many of the banks have been nationalized or gone bust. So these are the surviving banks, and they're not doing very well either. When we look at, for example, Deutsche Bank, this is an institution that is in severe strife, and there is a likelihood that it is going to require capital from the German sovereign. Well, then when we look at what's going on in terms of the Italian bond market, well, this does look like an index that is going to move higher, but yields were pulling back in here over the last few days. The Bank of Italy was saying that the quantity of debt is an issue, and the Italian government has been a little bit more realistic about their objectives and their engagement with the EU. And the EU is starting to talk about how can they loosen fiscal rules in order to support member economies that are falling into stress. So Europe is beginning to talk about how it can solve its problems, but the problem with a lot of the European solutions is that they're consensus-driven and they require Germany's sign-off, and that is a very slow process. The problem that they have is that markets tend to move faster. So that does represent an issue for Europe. Europe represents a very significant risk. And when we think about the fact that the dollar has been rallying, well, there are two halves to every currency trade. Europe needs a weaker currency. There is no country wants a strong currency, but some need a weaker currency more than others. Well, Europe needs a weaker currency. There is no doubting that. And it continues to hold this sequence of lower rally highs. On the other side of the equation, because you have simultaneous selling of equities and bonds, then people are moving into cash. That's creating demand for dollars at the same time that the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet. So that's creating a lack of supply of dollars. And then, of course, you have the massive sources of US dollar denominated debt that is sitting on the balance sheets of the emerging markets, and they are also short dollars. So that is creating a supply inelasticity meets rising demand environment for the dollar. So that's not just a euro question, but it is a global dollar shortage question. And that's very significant. Well, then that really does nail home the point that the Federal Reserve is the central banker to the world. And if they continue to raise interest rates, then it is going to create a recession. We are at the point now where it is reasonable to conclude that rates are at a neutral level. I think it's very likely they're going to continue to raise rates, and they're definitely going to raise rates in December. But the much bigger question is whether after that they announce that they're going to have a pause. One of the things that has certainly been coming to mind over the course of the last few months is that we have finished the second year of the presidential cycle. And what we anticipate, and what is more than normal, is that we get a wobble in the stock market at the beginning of the third year. And the third year, or at least when the Trump administration took office, was at the beginning of 2017. So it's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we do get a stock market wobble between now and June of next year. And then we start to see things picking up, and that we get a much stronger performance in 2020. Now, that's on the assumption that the Federal Reserve stops raising interest rates. Because usually what happens is that at the beginning of the presidential cycle, they clean the Augean stables, they raise interest rates. That's exactly what the Fed did. And then we've had this fiscal stimulus, which is widely anticipated to be losing impetus. So that's certainly fitting into the presidential cycle narrative. Then, because there's a lagged effect from raising interest rates, it takes a while for them to start to bite. Well, that's exactly what we're starting to see now. It's rational that the Federal Reserve should start to be thinking about stopping raising interest rates. And then they should start to cut interest rates as we move into the latter half of the presidential cycle, which then also gives some impetus to the re-election potential for the incumbent. So that's generally speaking the rationale or the narrative behind the presidential cycle, and this is the time to be thinking about it since we're about halfway through it. But in the event that that does not occur, well, I think that is going to be one of the facts that creates a recession. The most reliable lead indicator for future recessions is the yield curve spread, and that is not yet negative, but it did contract this week. So it has been contracting since October. Now, the big question is whether it goes inverted. Now, if it becomes inverted, well, then what that generally means is that banks stop making money because the way that banks make money is they borrow short and lend long. But if they can't do that, if the cost of borrowing is higher than what they can lend it out at, they stop lending. And then that acts as a brake on the economy, and then you do get a recession. So We're at the point where that is starting to become a realistic possibility. Now, we're definitely in a medium-term correction in terms of stock markets. And certainly, we've had a lot of pricing in of some very bullish prognostications on the largest shares. Certainly, I'm posting an article in here today from Fortune, which is written by a value investor, and he is making the case for investing in companies like Amazon, Google, and Apple. He's making all the same arguments that everyone else has been making for years, but he's preaching to a group of people that did not participate in the bull market. Well, that's pretty worrying. Value investors are very good at picking bottoms. But they have no tools in their toolkit for identifying tops. And when value investors start to embrace the bullish narrative, then that's generally not a great, that's really not good news. When we look at the consistency of trends, generally speaking, you anticipate that a trend is going to become more consistent the longer it persists for. And that did occur. The advance we saw in 2017 was unrelenting. We didn't have a reaction of more than about 3% in the entire year. And then there was some evidence of acceleration at the top. Well, now the question is the low going to hold? Most particularly this 2500 point level. It's, I think, could reasonably be described as the neckline for this range. And that is a very big question. Well, I do think that there is a good argument for why the Federal Reserve should stop raising interest rates. Now you have the bigger question and something that we're going to find out in the next week. In fact, it's going to be the week after next week, when Xi and Trump meet at the G20. Well, I anticipate that we're going to get at least a nominal bump from that because they're going to come out with a more friendly tone. And not least because I think that what Pence and Trump are playing is an example of good cop and bad cop. So we know what the challenges are. The harsh reality is that China was invited into the WTO on the assumption, and it was unfortunately a wrong assumption, but it was invited into the WTO on the assumption that by promoting economic growth, that they would therefore adopt more capitalism and liberalism and democracy. Well, they embraced capitalism all right, but they have doubled down on their authoritarianism. Well, the stealing of IP or intellectual property, the breaking of trade rules, the funding of operations to drive market share advances and at unprofitable rates, which has created massive steel overproduction, cement overproduction, aluminium overproduction, that has contributed to solar cell overproduction and is likely to commoditize battery technology as well. Well, these are all issues that should have been addressed by the WTO and weren't. Then it has also denuded the manufacturing sectors of North America and Europe, and that has been one of the contributing effects of the rise of populism. So that is something that's going to have to be addressed eventually. And China is an emerging power; it's an emerging economic power and an emerging military power. Its own economy is slowing. It's at a point where is running a significant risk of falling victim to the middle income trap, and in order to vault itself up into true, I think, developed market status, then it's going to have to embrace reform. But there doesn't seem to be a great deal of appetite for that. what we've certainly seen in China is that in rather than embrace liberalism and reform, that they are doubling down on state control. And there is an awful lot of money that is locked up in the property market. Well, lower interest rates globally, availability of credit, and funding and support from governments has helped to support property markets all over the world. And when you start to see the leverage ratios getting up to 14 times or 15 times the wage rate of citizens, well, that is also one of the things that creates social strife. That's where we are in places like London and Sydney and Vancouver and Toronto and in Hong Kong. So we're at a point now where the prices for property are extraordinarily high and the Chinese economy is starting to slow. Well, then that is also going to have ripple effects just about everywhere else. The fact is that China is a major economy, and that in the absence of clear sources of support, then it's going to continue to trend lower. They're talking about a growth rate of 6.5%, but I think we have to start pricing in the potential that in the absence of a clear change in the trend, that the Chinese economy could have a recession. And if China has a recession, then that is going to have a knock-on effect for just about everywhere else. But of course, the epicenter of risk will have ripple effects, and the closer one is to the epicenter, then the greater the risk is. Well, the greatest risk, therefore, is in Australia or in Europe. So these are markets that I think are worth keeping a very close eye on because they're not looking especially consistent either. And Australia in particular has got a really very big exposure to the Chinese economy, not least in terms of its exports, but also in terms of its property market. So the resources sector in Australia has been holding up better than just about everywhere else, and not least because of the weakness of the Aussie dollar, but it broke down in here this week. So this is now a meaningful loss of uptrend consistency. Well, when we look at the Australian dollar, that it had come all the way down to 70 cents and then it bounced, and it's had a reasonably successful bounce that broke the sequence of lower rally highs, but now it has to hold it. And the weakness in the Chinese economy is a significant factor. Now, the big question is what the result is going to be from that G20 meeting between Xi and Trump, because if it's not a successful meeting, well, then the renminbi is almost certainly going to weaken through the seven level. Well, the big thing that China has been trying to avoid is capital flight. And if the renminbi breaks down, well, then that's going to be a signal to an awful lot of Chinese investors to try and get their money out of the country. And that is the entire reason behind this social credit score mechanism that they're trying to implement. Because what they're trying to do is to have total surveillance on the finances of the entire population in order to curtail their ability to move money overseas. So we're at, I think, a very critical juncture. It's not just for Wall Street, but for Europe and for China. This is the point at which central banks are potentially going to make a policy mistake. So there is the potential here that we are in a medium-term correction that will be resolved on the upside. And if it is going to be resolved on the upside, well, then we're going to have to see that some change in the monetary environment is coming through. Well, the pace of the decline in central bank assets has moderated, and we're starting to hear things that are straws in the wind in terms of monetary policy from the Federal Reserve. So it isn't that there is no chance that we're going to see something to really help to support these markets, but we don't have it yet. And what that suggests is that we are still in this corrective phase, and that there are an increasing number of companies that have lost uptrend consistency. Well, the sector of the market that is doing best is the kinds of companies that look like floating rate notes, in that they have the ability to raise their dividends. So it has been companies like McDonald's and Coca-Cola that have been driving the advance, but they are short-term overbought. And sorry, being a bit dyslexic in my typing, and they do look now like they are having some pause in consolidation. Coca-Cola had a downside Q reversal this week, and it followed through on the downside on Wednesday. So that also looks like a reversionary process back towards the mean. Then, when we look at some of the other, I think, big consumer companies, well, they all look a little bit overbought in the short term and susceptible to some pause and consolidation. Then, if we look at the utility sector, that has been one of the questions that's puzzled a lot of investors. Why has it been such a source of relative strength? Well, it's because they can raise their dividends. Well, the underperformance of some of those Californian utilities has been a significant factor in the underperformance of the wider market in here this week because of the risk that's outstanding there. So there is, I think, a great deal of uncertainty that is assailing the market right now. This is the point at which we should see some support from central banks. If we get it, well, then it's going to be like 2015 and 2016, and then we can have the potential for a significant breakout later. But if we don't see it, and if central banks make a mistake and tighten too much and have a deleterious effect on the global economy, well, then we're talking about an unwinding and a completing top formation. So this is, I think, a rather critical juncture that we're at here. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.